It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The year 2015 is far from over, but when we look back on this year, one of the highlights will no doubt be the U.S. Women's National Team's victory in the World Cup of Soccer. One of the stars of that team is from the Pittsburgh area, Richland native Megan Klingenberg, a starting defender for the U.S. team. Klingenberg played all 630 minutes of the World Cup tourney. She also scored a goal and famously celebrated by waving a terrible towel in a victory tour friendly with Costa Rica at Heinz Field. Today, Megan Klingenberg joins us in studio to take your questions and discuss the growth of girls' soccer in the Pittsburgh area, as well as how becoming a sports celebrity has changed her life. Megan Klingenberg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
If you want to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Lots of tweets to get to. And if you want to ask the question you've always wanted to ask Megan Klingenberg, 412-246-2002, the number to call to join us on the air. I was reading that right after winning the World Cup, your schedule was so hectic, so many demands were being made on your time that you were just exhausted. Have things begun to settle down a bit for you?
No, honestly, it's pretty much still like that. But
you're on Essential Pittsburgh, so that's proof of that, right?
Yeah, I'm home about only 2 or 3 days a month. And when I'm home, I really try and relax. So I'm happy to be here. This is like part of my relaxed time. So
good.
But this is fun for me. This is easy. It's nice talking, being in studio, talking with you, Paul. So it's good to be here, and I'm pretty excited about, you know, being on Essential Pittsburgh.
At one point during the World Cup tournament, you said the World Cup experience was hard to describe because of the mix of emotions you feel every day playing for your country. Having had a few months to put that in perspective, how would you describe it now?
Still, and I'm not sure there's really words to describe what winning a World Cup feels like. When I was running around the field afterwards, when we had just beaten Japan, I grabbed a corner of the flag, and one of my teammates, Becky Sauerbrunn, the center defender that played right next to me, she grabbed the other corner of the flag, and we were running around the field, and we were waving it as hard as we could, and waving it so hard that, like, I think my arm almost fell off, but that was really the only moment that I was able to kind of soak in and appreciate what we had done. I was just in awe of what we had accomplished because of how many years we put in training, sacrificing, and doing all these things that we need to do to be able to be World Cup champions, and feeling that love, that energy from the fans, and thanking them as we're running around the field and waving the flag was a really special moment. And I'm not sure that I've been able to have another moment like that yet, because I just haven't had any time to settle down and really appreciate what we've done.
How has your newfound celebrity changed your life?
I love how you're calling it newfound celebrity. That's so funny. I don't think of myself as a celebrity at all, but
you are, though.
If you say so.
Well, all right, let me give you an example. You have the same number, 22, as Pirates center fielder Andrew McCutchen, who is an all-star and an MVP, and you know he's been on Ellen and proposed on Ellen. So he tweeted that you and he might have to settle who wears number 22 best for Pittsburgh. I mean, that's pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy. I mean, that competition or whatever needs to really happen, because I think that, you know, that's a battle that people would want to see.
And this is something that I read that sort of I thought was funny, where you said, "I'm not as cool as they think I am." Why is that?
100%. I mean, I come home, I like doing Sudoku puzzles. I mean, I really love to just go to the gym and train, and then I'll go to the field and train, and literally I'll come back and I'll cook some food with my mom. And that is literally my day. So I'm totally not as cool as people think I am, but I just live a pretty simple life.
And you're still as much as you can living in this area.
Yeah. I absolutely love being in Pittsburgh. I think it's a wonderful place filled with good people. So I try and be here as much as possible, especially in the summer months, but I try and avoid it a little bit, kind of when it starts getting cold and dark and wintry.
Like it's about to.
Exactly, yes. I'll probably be going south, snowbird at 27.
Let's check out some of what the folks on Twitter are saying and asking, April says, what would Kling, Kling, of course, being your nickname, what would Kling be doing with her life if not for soccer or Taekwondo? Apparently she knows something I don't know. Are you into Taekwondo?
Well, I was into Taekwondo, and when I was younger, I took it for probably about 10 years, and I eventually reached the level of third-degree black belt in Taekwondo. So
wow.
People seem to love that.
So you're how big?
5'2", 5'3". Usually I give myself 5'3".
And you weigh?
Are you supposed to ask a woman that question?
I'm
just totally messing with you.
If she's an athlete, then maybe.
I'm totally kidding.
You had me. I was like ready to dive under the table.
No.
My point being that I'm probably not quite a foot taller than you, but taller and larger. And yet you could, you've got that Taekwondo experience. You could just, put me right through that glass next to us, separating us from the next studio.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but it's been an incredibly important part of my life. I think that it taught me a lot of things about focus and discipline and balance and different types of movements. So that has been kind of an irreplaceable part of my training for a World Cup and things like that.
So I don't know if we answered the question. So what would you be doing if not for soccer or Taekwondo?
Geez, that's such a tough question, because when I look at my life, I knew when I was younger that I was really good at movement. I was really good at being athletic. I was really good at being in control of my body. So I always wanted to move as my job and do something where I'm outdoors and things like that. But I graduated with a business degree from the University of North Carolina, and I concentrated in entrepreneurship because I think it's super fun. It kind of takes the same hustle and work ethic and drive to be an entrepreneur as it does to be an athlete. So I think if I wasn't playing soccer, I would absolutely want to be working in startups and totally hustle in that walk of life, kind of like I'm, hustling now for soccer.
Very interesting. Well, there you go, April. There's your answer. And also another of your fans on Twitter asks, what advice would you give to someone who wants to pursue soccer professionally, which you have because you're playing in the, I think it's the North American Women's Soccer League. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's the National Women's Soccer League.
National Women's Soccer League.
So I guess my advice that I always give to young players, men or women, is to whenever you're doing anything, whether it's soccer, whether it's school, whether it is learning to play the piano, to pursue that to the best of your ability, to reach your personal potential. Because if you're able to be passionate about the sport, able to be passionate about whatever you're doing and reach your personal potential, then you'll never be disappointed at anything that you do. And even if you don't make it to being professional, you know that you put your all in it and you've reached your personal potential. Your potential just isn't good enough to be an athlete. But that doesn't mean that you haven't learned lessons and learned really important things along the way. So that's really my advice to kids, people my age, older people, whatever, is do anything that you do to your ultimate potential.
If you have a comment or question and you want to tweet us, we're at ESSPGH, and we'll get to some more of your tweets coming up. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. And if you're brave enough to join us on the air, 412-246-2002, the number to call, 412-246-2002. It had been 16 years since the United States had won the World Cup. You're old enough that you remember that. Though you were just a kid and already playing soccer by that time, 1999, when the U.S. beat China in that thrilling final game, 1-0 on the penalty kicks at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. So all that time has passed. You've grown up. The country has fallen in love with women's soccer, but it had still been waiting for it to win another World Cup. So here you go into the tournament in North America. It's in Canada. Were you feeling as that tournament began that this may be as good a chance as we're ever going to have and we have to take advantage of it?
Yeah, 100%. I think you have to feel that way going into any world tournament, though. They're every 4 years. That's a really, really incredibly long stretch of time to wait for the next World Cup. So this was my first World Cup, and I knew that it could quite possibly be my last. You never know what could happen in those 4 years. Ultimately, I would love to be a part of that next World Cup team. But you don't know whether you're going to have an injury, whether life just gets in the way. So I knew going
into
that.
That's a really good point.
I knew that going into this, we had some older players on the team, some absolute superstars, and that it would probably be their last go around. So we were focusing on winning for us, but we also wanted to win for those players because we knew how much time and effort and how much they had pushed the game, the women's sports, into the forefront of this society's mind. So we wanted to win for us, but we wanted to win for Abby, and we wanted to win for Boxy, and we wanted to win for Christy Rampone and all these older players that maybe they won't make another World Cup cycle.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Megan Klingenberg. We have Nancy on the line from Squirrel Hill. Hi, Nancy. You're on with Megan.
Hi, Megan. How are you guys today?
Good. How are you, Nancy?
I'm good. You know, Megan, in general, you know, I'm in my 50s, and soccer really wasn't an option as we were growing up. But now soccer has really exponentially taken off. My kids, they had that option. They did it when they were really little, up and through high school. But my question more than soccer is women's sports in general and how you really feel from your perspective what you guys can do with this to really help keep women's sports going and getting funded and things like that. There was something on this morning with Frank DeFord. He talked about it. But I'll just leave that question with you guys to talk about. Thank you.
Okay. Well, what about Nancy's question?
Well, thank you, Nancy. I think it's a wonderful question. And what's really cool about the U.S. Women's National Team is that we are averaging over 30,000 fans every game that we play in the United States. And at that type of attendance with this type of, gosh, brand awareness, I guess you could say, we're earning a profit for our federation. And so we're not just a team that is going to be funded by another men's team or charity or anything like that. So to me, this is a huge opportunity for women in soccer, women in sports, because we're able to actually turn a profit for our federation, and it's a good profit. So I look at us as the second wave of pioneers behind the 1999 Women's World Cup winning team. They were the first wave, and we are absolutely the second wave of pioneers pushing our sport into the forefront of America's, gosh, consciousness. And hopefully we continue to, you know, build on this type of, hyper awareness of our sport. And we're able to continue to average 30,000 fans going into the next World Cup and push that on to 50,000 and start filling up Heinz Field all the way. Even though it was a great crowd, I want to fill it up to 60,000. That'd be incredible. So I think we absolutely have the chance to do that, and we're trying to make the most of it right now.
Is women's soccer on an equal footing with men's soccer? And I bring this up because, as I'm sure you're well aware, having been there, at this year's World Cup in Canada, the games, including the championship, were played on artificial turf. Many of the women on the U.S. team were not happy about that. Soccer at the highest levels around the world is played on grass. When the Men's World Cup was held in the United States back in 1994, grass was brought into places like Giant Stadium, which had artificial turf. Are women not getting the same respect on the world stage as men in soccer?
It's a really interesting question. When it comes to respect towards a women's game, I only see there being an increase in respect and appreciation for the game, because I think that people can see how hard we work. We work as hard as the guys do. We put in as much time as the guys do, and we're paid much, much less than the men are. So to me, people around the world are seeing, gosh, soccer played at a high level by women, as you could see during the Summer World Cup, and that respect is increasing. But we're not there yet. I think for people to ultimately have enough, the same amount of respect for the men's game as they do for the women's game, we'll have to continually earn as much money for our federations, for our clubs, to even be considered in the same stratosphere. And don't ask me if that's fair or not. I mean, I can't answer that, but all I know is that hopefully we can get to that level someday so we're able to command that type of respect from FIFA so we don't have to play on turf, so we're not playing on this surface that's at higher risk for creating injuries and, you know, kind of levels the playing field when you're playing against a team that maybe isn't as skillful as another team because there's bumps in the turf, because it rolls differently, because it's faster, because the ball can go out of play more, because the team can slow it down. So there's a lot of different factors when it comes to playing on the turf, and hopefully we can kind of level that playing field. And I think we're making strides, but we still have more to make.
In soccer, unlike basketball or hockey, where there's a player substitution, when there is one, in soccer, the player who goes out is done for the game. Would soccer be better served to have free substitutions where a player can go take a breather, then come back in? Not that the pace of these games wasn't exciting enough, but could it make the game even more exciting?
I'm sure it could make the game more exciting, but it completely changes the quality of the match. It changes the
for better
the spirit of the match. It changes the spirit of the game. And that's like saying, gosh, we're going to change the height of the hoop in basketball in the NBA.
That drastic?
I think so. I really think it would. If you look at the college game as opposed to the professional women's level or the World Cup level, the college game has unlimited subs. Pretty much. And you only have three in professional leagues. Mm-hmm. And teams are able to win games in college based upon their fitness, based upon just being able to get in fresh legs. And you're not able to do that. It's more of a chess match when you're playing in the professional leagues. So I think it would just change the spirit of the game. And that's not something that I would ever want to endorse.
Sure. Well, and you say this as someone who played all 630 minutes of the World Cup tournament, every minute of every game.
Yes, that's true, but I didn't play very many minutes my first 2 years when I was on the team. So maybe if you asked me the question, you know, in 2010 when I was sitting the bench a lot, I would have a different answer.
Did you go into this tournament thinking, okay, I'm not going to be coming off that field unless I get hurt?
Well, that's what I think every time I step on the field. I don't ever want to come off. I love playing the game so much, and I want to be the best, and I want to be ultra competitive, that ideally what I think when I go onto the field is I want to take my flag that is, you know, it says Megan Klingenberg on it, and it's Carolina blue, and I want to plant it on my side of the field, and I want to wave it high, and I want to make sure everybody knows that that's my side of the field, and I'm going to dominate it. And that is what I think every time when I'm stepping on the field. I don't care who we're playing, because I think you have to play teams the same, whether it's Haiti, whether it's Costa Rica, or Germany, or Japan. You give teams respect by absolutely wanting to dominate them. And that's, to me, earning respect. Because, you know, you could walk on the field and just be like, oh, we're playing Haiti, I'm just going to, like, screw around and do whatever, do this. But no. To me, it's respect comes from when a player comes on the field and takes you seriously.
I am so intimidated right now. You've planted that Carolina blue Tar Heels flag on your side of the desk, and I'm going to stay on this side. And we're going to continue our conversation with Megan Klingenberg of the world champion, the World Cup champion, U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. There's a few more things I wanted to ask you, Megan, about the World Cup. Hopefully you don't get tired of reliving it.
No, never.
At what point, the United States was certainly not a hands-down favorite to win this tournament, if a favorite at all. So at what point do you feel that things turned in the U.S. favor during that tournament when you realized that we've got a shot at taking this title, finally?
We definitely weren't favorites in the public realm, but in our own minds, we definitely thought that we could win the World Cup. We knew at the beginning of the tournament we were not playing up to our potential, but there were some really positive things that we were doing, and we were, you know, keeping clean sheets. We were limiting
shutting their team out, just for people who aren't familiar with.
Sorry, yeah, exactly. Good. We weren't allowing any goals, and we were not allowing many chances for the other teams to score goals on us. So we were doing some things really, really great. And I knew once we got it in our minds that we were able to score goals and, like, produce and have quality chances on the net, then we were going to be a force to be reckoned with. And as soon as we played in that China game, something clicked that game where we were able to fire on all cylinders. And after that, there was no stopping us because we were solid defensively and we were scoring goals and we were just clicking. And it was so fun to be a part of.
Does any of the tension right now, there's the president of China came over here for talks with President Obama, and there's a lot of political tension between our two countries. Does that ever carry over to the field? Do you ever sense that when you're, you know, on the field playing against the Chinese players?
Honestly, for me, it has nothing to do with it. I want to win regardless of who we're playing, but I know that there are political ramifications to every game that we play, to every meeting between, you know, different countries. It's really interesting when we play North Korea. I played them in the U-20 Women's World Cup in 2008 when we were in Chile, and we played them in the final match. The USA ended up winning, and we went to shake their hands after the game, and they wouldn't shake our hands. And to us, you know, at first we thought it was, you know, unsportsmanlike. But honestly, I think that it wasn't unsportsmanlike. It was probably, you know, self-preservation for them as opposed to them being a poor sport. They're not able to be photographed shaking Americans' hands. That
really
would not go over well, I don't think, in North Korea. So it's really interesting because I don't think about those political ramifications when I'm playing. I just want to win. But obviously other players do have to think about those things.
You had one of the iconic moments in the World Cup where you made a goal line clearing header to preserve a scoreless draw with Sweden in that group stage game, that group of death, as they called it. What do you remember about that play?
Oh, it's so funny. People tweeted me after the game and, you know, they started calling it the immaculate deflection, which, by the way, I thought was the funniest thing ever. So whoever tweeted that at me, thank you so much. You've totally made my year with that. I honestly was just doing my job. We had practiced a day before set pieces, and I knew that this was going to be a game where I needed to slide across because they were going to serve back post on us, and Hope was going to have to come out and try and win it.
Hope Solo, the goalie.
Exactly. Hope Solo was going to have to come out and try and win it with her hands. And so I was on the post, and whenever Hope goes out to the far, you know, far back corner to try and win the ball, I need to slide over into the middle of the goal because I need to protect the line. So I was just basically doing my job, and luckily it came right at me because it was coming really, really fast, and I barely got ahead on it, and it went up straight out, and thank goodness.
Yeah, really. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and yeah, I hope that Hope Solo said, you know, I'm going to buy you, well, maybe it wouldn't be a beer, but a Gatorade afterwards.
I told her she could buy me a car, but I still haven't gotten one.
Well, she may get to the point where she can afford to do that. You never know. Our guest is Megan Klingenberg, Richland native, a big part of the U.S. team's victorious effort in the Women's World Cup this past summer. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. As part of the victory tour, the U.S. team had a game, what they call a friendly, at Heinz Field last month, an 8-0 victory over Costa Rica. You scored a goal in that game, which was nationally televised. Let's listen to announcer John Paul Della Camera's description of the moment.
In front, quick shot, there's another goal. The hometown girl strikes, it's Klingenberg.
Tobin Heath with an excellent run in. And Megan Klingenberg, all she has to do is just put it into the far post, beats her defender on her run. And what a special goal for Klingenberg. She was one of the best players in the United States in the World Cup. And I love the tribute to her hometown.
And the tribute being that you grabbed a terrible towel and ran around swinging that on the field. Where did that towel come from?
Honestly, this is such a funny story because I was going to bring a terrible towel with me, but I had forgotten it at my house. So I didn't have anything, you know, I didn't have a terrible towel. I didn't have anything Pittsburgh related on me going into the game. But Jill told me that she was going to do, our coach, Jill Ellis, told me she was going to move me up into midfield at halftime to try and get a goal. And so I was lined up at half, ready for the whistle. I'm on her side, and she just kind of wags like a little yellow tail at me. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you have got to be kidding me. I was like, I'm coming to you. If I score, be ready. And she's like, all right, I'm ready. So I scored, and I, like, sprinted over there, high-fived all my teammates. And she did, like, a perfect, throw to me, and I just caught it.
She lateraled
just,
it to you.
Yeah, she lateraled it right to me, and I just started twirling it in the air, and it was such a special moment because I've never heard a crowd that cheer that loud in my life.
It was a special moment. I think the image of that, I think, is going to rank right up there in Pittsburgh lore with, you know, Franco taking the immaculate reception to the end zone, or Roberto on second base, you know, with the cap held over his head after his 3,000th hit. I mean, that struck such a chord with people in Pittsburgh. And the crowd was the largest for a soccer game in Pittsburgh, which set a U.S. women's team record for a standalone friendly, a game that's not part of a doubleheader or official competition. Were you confident that Pittsburgh sports fans were going to step up like this? Because women's soccer had not really drawn well up to that point.
No, that's very true. But I was 100% confident that Pittsburgh fans would show up. I knew how passionate they were and how much energy they had during the World Cup. My mom was telling me about it. My friends were telling me about it. I heard that they filled up, you know, parks watching the game, and people were just totally into it. So I knew that it was going to be a big match with a lot of fans there. But I never imagined in my wildest dreams that many people would show up and that many people would be so excited about us being there.
How did playing at Pine Ridgeland put you on a path to success, to greatness?
This is always such a fun question because, as you know, Neil Walker and Brandon Saw, you know, the Blackhawks player.
Well, now he's a Columbus Blue Jacket.
True,
I think.
Columbus
yeah,
Blue Jackets right. player. You know, both went to Pine Ridgeland, but it's an incredibly great school. I was so well prepared going into college, and taking my courses in the business school that I know other students were not able to manage because they just hadn't been prepared well enough during their high school years. So I can't thank my teachers at Pine Ridgeland enough for that type of, you know, preparation for college. I never would have made it through school without them. So if you guys are listening, I truly appreciate it.
Jubilee on Twitter asks, do you have any pregame rituals or superstitions?
Heck no, I definitely don't have any superstitions. No. They take way too much time and effort, and I'm already stressed out enough going into every game, so I don't need to add any more stress to my plate.
Stephanie has this question. What are the biggest differences between Houston and Pittsburgh? She's asking this because you play in Houston professionally. What's been the most surprising and difference, I guess she's asking, and do you miss anything from one in the other, or one or the other, I guess?
I mean, does she mean besides the heat? Does the heat index and the humidity? But yeah, Houston's a really great place, but Pittsburgh holds my heart for sure. I love being here. I love the food. I love the people. I love that I get to visit my family. I love that how beautiful it is downtown. But there are certain parts of Houston that I think are really great, too, like the Mexican food. You can't get better Mexican food than in Houston, Texas. And
I had some in Johnstown last night. You're saying it's better than that?
Well, it's pretty authentic in Houston, Texas, I will say. So there are definitely things that are really, really cool. And it's a really big city, so there's always something, you know, buzzing and going on. And to me, that part's really fun. And the weather in the winter, you can't beat.
You hold an annual soccer camp in the area. How does the Pittsburgh area rate when it comes to producing soccer talent?
At this point, we haven't really had that many players move on to D1 colleges or into the U.S. Women's National Team program. I think I'm really the only Pittsburgh player that has played in a world tournament. And that needs to change because we have so much talent here. We have women and girls that are interested in sports. And that's not like that in many other places. Women aren't interested in sports. I can't tell you how many women in other places don't watch their hometown football teams or or hometown hockey or the Pirates or whatever. And here we absolutely have a great female fan base that watches a lot of sports. And so it's ingrained in us from a young age.
But does watching it, and obviously you were inspired as a young lady, does watching it, though, translate to wanting to participate? Do we sometimes get caught up in being too, living vicariously through the athletes that we see on the field than see on television, maybe not get out there and participate ourselves? Is that why we haven't had other Megan Klingenbergs coming out of Pittsburgh?
I hear what you're saying, but I think we're Pittsburgh tough, and I just think that there's not necessarily enough exposure for girls in the Pittsburgh area to be able to play on a higher level. I think that the system that we have in place right now, you know, with club teams, there's too many club teams, there's not enough players on just like one or two really good club teams, and then there's a couple mediocre ones, and then there's some ones that are more rec league. I think it needs to be set up differently, and if we set it up in a different way, then we will definitely have players that are coming out of this region that will be great for D1 colleges and hopefully in the future for the U.S. Women's National Team, because I've seen the talent that we have, and it's no different than New Jersey or California, where they have really, really incredible youth programs. But then there comes a point where those New Jersey and California kids kind of leapfrog ahead of us, and we need to figure out where that's happening and why that's happening.
You have become certainly a role model for young girls who are interested in athletics in Pittsburgh and this area. And I read that you said it's weird to think of yourself as a role model to young girls. Why is that?
Because it's weird because I think of myself as just living to be a good person, living to be a good sister, a good daughter. And I don't really think about living to be a good role model for millions of young women, young boys. And honestly, all I try and ever do is just live to be a good person. Because if you live to be a good person, then that kind of translates into being a good role model. But I don't necessarily think about it in the sense of, oh, I need to do this way because I'm a role model for young people. No, I just do things the way that I do them because I want to be a good person. Does that make sense?
Sure it does. Sure it does.
So I don't think of it. I never think of it in a way as, oh, I need to, you know, be on the radio and do these things because I want to be a good role model. I think about it as, oh, I do these things because I want to be a good person and live my life to the best of my ability.
Next summer, the Olympic soccer tournament is being held with the rest of the Olympic Games, of course, in Brazil. Have you begun to work earnestly toward that next goal of winning a gold medal?
Such a good question. I always am looking towards the next thing. When the final whistle blew on the World Cup and we had our celebration party that night, and the next morning I was thinking about the Olympics and what I want to make that team, and I want to be on that team because I love training and I love practicing. So I have no problem putting in the work. But as of right now, what I'm really trying to do is kind of wind down from my season, wind down from the World Cup. We played up until 2 weeks ago with the Houston Dash, my professional team in Houston. And right now I'm just trying to give my body a rest and kind of rejuvenate. And then we'll really start hitting it hard probably at the end of November and into December. And then it'll be full steam ahead for the Olympics.
We're down to just a few seconds. Will the U.S. team come back to Pittsburgh?
Oh, after that type of crowd, I sure hope so.
We do too. And we hope you come back to Essential Pittsburgh. But in the meantime, it's been great having you here, World Cup soccer champion, Richland native Megan Klingenberg. Thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
No, thank you. I've had an absolute blast. It's been really, really fun.
Cool. Come back.
All right.
Coming up, a conversation with BBC correspondent James Kumarasamy about covering President Obama, Vladimir Putin, and much more. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Nice to know you. We'll be right back.